This audio program is brought to you courtesy of Audible.com. Audible, audio that speaks to you wherever you are.
Leap of Faith by Queen Noor. Read by Her Majesty Queen Noor and Suzanne Torin.
For my beloved Hussein, light of my life. Acknowledgements. I always imagined that if I were to try to tell my story, that I would do so in a quiet, reflective period toward the end of my active life, when there might be an almost complete story to tell. However, after my husband's death, many people encouraged me to share my memories and my perspective on Hussein's legacy at a time when it might be of particular relevance. This book was written in the spirit of reconciliation, which I hope will contribute to a greater awareness, especially in the West, of events that have shaped the modern Middle East, and encourage a deeper understanding of contemporary challenges facing the Arab world, as well as an appreciation for the true values of Islam. I have often spoken about the need to build bridges between cultures as a way to promote constructive dialogue. It is my fervent hope that this book will inspire some of its readers to put those ideals into practice. I do not claim to be a political scientist, historian, or theologian. I have tried to write accurately and from first-hand experience whenever possible. The responsibility for the views expressed in these pages is, of course, mine alone, but they were refined in the course of many spirited conversations with friends and advisors. These are my views, however, and should not be construed as the official Jordanian government position. Memoirs are, by definition, a deeply personal undertaking, requiring reflection and a measure of introspection. This book was no exception. During this sometimes painful and often painstaking endeavor, I was very fortunate to have the assistance of many exceptional and creative minds. In the initial research and information gathering stage, Linda Bird Franke and I spent many hours reviewing primary source materials, especially my daily journals of the past 25 years. Linda traveled to Jordan, where she interviewed our family, friends, and my working colleagues. Victoria Pope has been an invaluable and indefatigable guide and friend throughout the critical culmination of the project, lending her many editorial talents to shaping the final text. The manuscript also benefited from Peter Guzzardi's deft line editing. Hanya Dagan deserves special thanks for her crucial involvement in the last hectic months before deadline, researching and coordinating the project while giving many thoughtful suggestions on how to improve the book's flow. Ghadir Taher and Basmalozi also contributed in many meaningful ways. I am grateful to Bob Barnett, Tina Brown, and Jonathan Burnham for believing in this book from the start. My thanks go also to Caroline McDaddy, Manal Jazzy, Carol Adwan, Gail Nash Brown, Elizabeth Cork, Diane Smith, Carlo Miotti, Jennifer Georgia, Tufan Kolan, Christine Anger, Lisa Segovia, Janelle Bragg, Susan Mercandetti, Hilary Bass, Jill Ellen Riley, Kristen Powers, and Kathy Berlin. Family members and friends also offered much appreciated advice and support. My parents, Doris and Najib Halabi, my brother Chris, my sister Alexa, and my cousins Rodrigo and Pedro Arboledo all helped to piece together our family story in the first chapters. Hussein's and my children, Faisal, Hamza, Hashim, Iman, Raya, and Abir, and our nephews Prince Talal and Prince Ghazi, Prince Raad and Princess Majda, Prince Ali bin Nayef and Princess Wijdan, and Prince Zayd bin Shakir, who supported and comforted so many of us after Sidi's death, until he left us too soon to join his dearest friend and brother. All helped me by sharing happy memories, as well as valuable historical and cultural perspectives. Many friends kindly lent their support, Queen Sophia, Empress Farah, King Constantine and Queen Anne-Marie, Swanee Hunt, Camille Douglas, Marion Freeman, Tessa Kennedy, Melissa Matheson, Sarah Pillsbury, Lucky Roosevelt, Gillian Rowan, Steven Spielberg, and Nadine Shubilat. Thank you. I'm especially indebted to the researchers as well as several dear friends who helped check and recheck facts on the region, including Mustafa Akkad, Aysar Akrawi, Fouad Ayoub, Lina Tell, Adnan Badran, Dr. Seema Bahuth, Ghazi Bisha, Timur Daghestani, Ali Ghandour, Sheikh Ahmed Hillel, Rana Husseini, Khaled Irani, Ibrahim Azadin, Abdul Karim Kabariti, Rami Khouri, Lina Kopti, Ali Mahafiza, Ashraf Malhas, Hussein Majali, Suleiman Al Musa, Sheikh Walid Al Said, Rebecca Salti, Kamil Sharif, Hannah Shaheen, Ali Shukri, Ja'afar Tukhan, Abla Zurhiqat, Dr. Fuad Ajami, Karim Fahim, Catherine Johnston Hutto, Dr. Sheila Johnson, Allison McIntyre, Megan Ring, Burdette Rooney, Jerry White, and Richard Verrill. The Jordanian graphic artist Andrea Talla contributed the beautiful Islamic designs that grace chapter openings. Finally, I would like to especially thank my children for their patience with my near-total immersion in the creation of this book over the last few years. It was their support and the memory of their father that kept me moving forward, even when the tasks seemed overwhelming. God bless you all. Chapter 1. First Impressions. I first met my future husband through the lens of a camera. I was standing with my father on the tarmac at the airport in Amman, Jordan, when King Hussein strolled over to greet us. Never one to hold back, my father thrust his camera into my hands. "Take my picture with the king," he said. Mortified, I nonetheless dutifully took the photograph, which caught the two men standing side by side with the king's eldest daughter, Princess Alia, in the background. Afterward, my father and the king exchanged a few words. Then King Hussein called his wife Queen Alia over to meet us. It was the winter of 1976. My father had asked me to join him on a brief visit to Jordan, where he had been invited to attend a ceremony marking the acquisition of the country's first Boeing 747. My father, Najib Halabi, a former airline executive and head of the Federal Aviation Administration, was chairman of the International Advisory Board for the Jordanian Airline. He was also in Amman laying the groundwork for a pan-Arab aviation university, an ambitious project aimed at reducing the region's dependence on foreign manpower and training. This undertaking, still in its infant stages, was the brainchild of King Hussein, my father, and other aviation dreamers in the Middle East. Since I was at loose ends, having recently completed a job in Tehran, I welcomed an opportunity to travel to Jordan, which I had visited briefly for the first time earlier that year. Another trip to this part of the Middle East would bring me back to the land of my ancestors and, I hoped, reconnect me with the Arab roots of my Halabi family. I distinctly recall my first impressions of Jordan. I had been en route to the United States from Iran, where I was working for a British urban planning firm. From the window of my aircraft, I had found myself spellbound by the serene expanse of desert landscape, washed golden by the retreating sun at dusk. I was overwhelmed by an extraordinary sensation of belonging, an almost mystical sense of peace. It was spring, a magical season in Jordan, when the winter-browned hills and valleys turn green from the winter rains, and wild anemones spring from the earth like red polka dots. Oranges, bananas, strawberries, tomatoes, and lettuces were being sold along the road through the lush fields and orchards of the Jordan River Valley, and city families from the high, cool Amman Plateau were picnicking along the warm shores of the Dead Sea. There was a warmth and joy in everyone and everything I saw, and I was entranced by the delightful harmony of past and present, of sheep grazing in fields and empty lots adjacent to sophisticated office buildings and state-of-the-art hospitals. I remember in particular the sight of students walking in the open fields at the edge of Amman, textbooks in hand, completely absorbed in their studies for the Tawjihi, a general government exam that Jordanians must take in the final year of high school. I knew from looking at maps how close Jordan was to Israel and the occupied Palestinian territories, but I had not fully understood it until I stood on the Jordanian shore of the Dead Sea and looked across at the ancient city of Jericho on the occupied West Bank. Jordan, in fact, had a longer border with Israel than any other country. It ran some 400 miles from Lake Tiberias, or the Sea of Galilee, in the north, to the Gulf of Aqaba in the south. Despite the enduring beauty of the landscape, World War II, three Arab-Israeli wars, and countless border skirmishes had left Jordan and Israel's ceasefire line, a sacred tract of land where the prophets once walked, riddled with landmines. My knowledge of Jordan then was limited to what I had read in newspapers or picked up in conversations, but I was aware of King Hussein's unique position in the region. He was a pan-Arabist with a deep understanding of Western culture, a consistent political moderate, and a dedicated member of the non-aligned movement. Jordan, I knew, was a linchpin for Middle East peace efforts, strategically located between Israel, Saudi Arabia, Syria, and Iraq. While in Jordan, I also learned that the king was a Hashemite, a direct descendant of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and therefore held a special position of respect for Muslims. The Jordan I visited for the first time in early 1976 was a fascinating blend of modernity and tradition. The Emirate of Transjordan was founded in 1921 and became the independent Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan in 1946. The country had been transformed by King Abdullah, its founder, and then by his grandson, King Hussein, and had steadily developed into a modern state. Having lost its historic access through Palestine to the commercial seaports of the Mediterranean due to the creation of Israel, Jordan had developed Aqaba as a port for traffic on the Red Sea and beyond to the Indian Ocean. When I first came to know Jordan, the government was initiating an ambitious overhaul of the country's telecommunications. At the time, it would take hours to call within Amman, and the capital did not even have international direct dialing. Birds alighting on the system's copper wires could cut telephone connections. But soon there would be a state-of-the-art network of telephone services linking the country in even its most remote areas. Smooth new roads had been built, mostly from north to south, to complement the traditional trade routes west through Palestine. You could easily drive, as I did, from Jordan's northern border with Syria all the way to Aqaba on the modern desert road. Traveling through the desert, I saw nomadic Bedouin tending to their livestock, and children darting in and out of the distinctive black goat-hair tents known as Beit Ashar. As day faded into night, I was transfixed by the rosy golden glow of the setting sun on the rocky hillsides, where herds of sheep looked almost iridescent in the waning light of day. The desert road was the fastest and most direct road to the south, but my favorite route was the scenic King's Highway, which followed the ancient trade routes. The three wise men are thought to have traveled at least part of the way to Bethlehem on the King's Highway, and Moses used it to lead his people toward Canaan. "We will stay on the King's Highway until we are out of your territory," reads Numbers 21:21-22 in the Bible, referring to Moses' request to King Sihon for permission to cross his kingdom, which was denied. Alternating between the two Nikon cameras I wore constantly around my neck, I took photograph after photograph of Mount Nebo, near where Moses is said to be buried, and of the magnificent mosaics I saw in nearby churches just off the King's Highway. Earlier civilizations kept the dirt track cleared of stones to hasten the passage of donkeys and camel caravans laden with gold and spices, and the Romans paved sections of the King's Highway with cobblestones to allow travel by chariot. Evidence of 10,000 years of history is scattered along or near the King's Highway, from striking plaster Neolithic statues with darkly lined eyes, the oldest representations of the human form, to the Iron Age capital of the Ammonites, Rabbat Ammon, which forms the nucleus of Jordan's present-day capital, Amman. The archaeological treasures I saw in Jordan during this early visit were stunning. Among them, the classical walled city of Jerash in the hills of Gilead, with its colonnaded streets, temples, and theaters. Lakes once covered the eastern desert, where fossilized lion's teeth and elephant's tusks can be found in the sand. On the road to Baghdad loomed the 1,300-year-old Islamic desert castles of the Umayyads, an Islamic dynasty established by the Caliph Muawiyah I in 661 BC. With their colorful frescoes and mosaics of birds, animals, and fruits, and heated indoor baths. A few hours to the south lies the ancient Nabataean city of Petra, carved into multicolored sandstone cliffs, hidden to the Western world for 700 years, until Swiss explorer Johann Burckhardt stumbled on it in 1812. Petra is entered through a mile-long narrow sikh, a natural gorge that cuts through the cliffs to emerge into a breathtaking marvel of shrines, temples, and tombs carved into the stone. It has a palette of natural colors and designs that no artist could duplicate, ancient caves and monuments whose floors and walls blaze with swirls of red, blue, yellow, purple, and gold veins of rock. On that first trip, I explored Amman on foot. Shepherds crossed the downtown streets with their flocks, herding them from one grassy area to another. They were such an ordinary part of life in Amman that no one honked or lost their patience waiting for the streets to clear. Animals and their minders had the right of way. I wandered through the marketplace, admiring the beautiful inlaid mother-of-pearl objects, frames, chests, and backgammon boards, as well as the cobalt blue, green, and amber vases known as Hebron glass. Amman looked classically Mediterranean, with its white limestone buildings and villas ranging over and beyond the seven fabled hills that Roman general Ptolemy II Philadelphus had conquered in the 3rd century BC. In my room in the Intercontinental Hotel, situated on a hill between two valleys, I lay awake each morning in the pre-dawn stillness, listening to the call to early morning prayers, al-Fajr. I was completely captivated by the rhythmic sound of the call to the faithful as it echoed off the surrounding hills. Jordan's capital was peaceful and calm, so different from the growing restiveness I had witnessed in the last months of my job in Tehran. On that fateful day, when my father introduced me to King Hussein on the tarmac, a dense cluster of people surrounded the monarch, members of his family, the royal court, government officials, including the CEO of the Jordanian airline, Ali Ghandour, an old friend of my father who had invited us to the ceremony. A lifelong aviator, the king was celebrating an exciting step forward for his beloved airline, which he considered a vital Jordanian link to the world. No doubt he simply longed to head for the cockpit of the country's first 747 and take off. Instead, he was surrounded by courtiers, officials, guards, and family members. It was as if an invisible string were holding them all together. When the king moved, the entire group would sway with him. As I watched, I was struck by the way the king never lost his composure or his smile, despite the overwhelming noise and confusion. For many years, I was reminded of that day at the airport by the photograph my father had asked me to take. During my engagement and after I married, I kept it in my office, still in the Photoshop's simple paper frame. Sadly, it was lost more than a decade ago when I asked to have a copy made. I keep hoping that it will fall out of a book or show up in a desk drawer. It is not often that one has a memento of the very first moment spent with someone who had become the most precious part of one's life. That short stay in Jordan ended with lunch at the King's seaside retreat in Aqaba, which had an appealing simplicity. Instead of living in an imposing vacation palace, the king and his family resided in a relatively modest beach house facing the sea. Guests and other family members were housed in a series of small, double-suite bungalows that made up the rest of the royal compound. The king was traveling at the time, but had asked Ali Ghandour to take my good friend Najib to lunch in Aqaba. Over the meza, an assortment of appetizers including tabbouleh, hummus, and marinated vegetables, the conversation veered quickly to politics, to Lebanon and its ongoing bloody civil war. I listened intently, asking many questions, fascinated by the complex political events of the region. Aqaba was a lovely spot, but our sojourn in Jordan was nearing its end. Soon I would be back in New York hunting for a job in journalism. I never imagined that I would be returning to Jordan just 3 months later, nor did I have any inkling of how fateful that return would be. Perhaps I should have taken more seriously a curious prediction made on one of my last evenings in Tehran just a few months earlier. At the end of a farewell dinner at a restaurant in the city center, an acquaintance at the table had told my fortune in the traditional Middle Eastern way by reading my coffee cup. He swirled the thick grounds, turned over the cup, flipped it back, and studied the patterns within. "You will return to Arabia," he had predicted, "and you will marry someone high-born, an aristocrat from the land of your ancestors."
Chapter 2. Roots. I first learned the history of my family when I was 6 years old in Santa Monica, California. One day in my parents' bedroom overlooking the ocean, my mother told me about my Swedish and European ancestry on her side of the family, and my Arab roots on my father's. I remember sitting there alone after our conversation, staring out the window at the limitless horizon of the ocean. It was as if my world had suddenly expanded. Not only did I have a new sense of identity, I felt connected for the first time to a larger family and a wider world. To my mother's long-standing frustration, I was most intrigued by my Arab roots. But how could my mother's hard-working, hardy forebears compete in my imagination with the dashing brothers Halabi? My Arab grandfather, Najib, and his older brother, Habib, were only 12 and 14 when they had sailed steerage from Beirut to Ellis Island with their mother, Almas, and younger siblings. They hailed from the Syrian city of Halab, or Aleppo, a great cultural capital and center of learning in the Arab world. My grandfather lived very briefly in the scenic riverside village of Zahle, Lebanon, before joining the family in Beirut for its voyage to the New World. Stored in their oversized carpet bags were Oriental rugs, damask fabric, copperware, and jewelry, fine wares from the old country to sell and trade while they adjusted to a new life. The Halabi boys barely spoke English and had no contacts, but they turned out to be as shrewd as they were charming. They took their carpet bags to the summer resort village of Bar Harbor, Maine, where Najib met and beguiled Frances Cleveland, the pretty young wife of President Grover Cleveland. The letters of introduction the first lady gave the young Arab ensured the brothers' initial success. Habib stayed in New York to work in the import-export business, while Najib moved on to Texas in pursuit of oil and cotton money. Darkly handsome, gallant, and exotic in socially conservative Dallas, Najib met and married interior decorator Laura Wilkins, the daughter of a local rancher, in 1914. Together, they founded Halabi Galleries, which combined his import-export skills with her love of art and decorating. Their business catered to the fashionably rich of Dallas, Houston, and Fort Worth. It was such a huge success that when Stanley Marcus and his partner, Al Neiman, doubled the size of their department store in downtown Dallas in the mid-1920s, they invited Najib and Laura Halabi to rent the top two floors to house the Halabi Galleries. More than half a century ago, that far-sighted troika of Neiman, Marcus, and Halabi created a center for the luxury trade in downtown Dallas. Perhaps this entrepreneurial instinct was a family trait. Camille, Habib and Najib's younger brother, was equally enterprising, though in a less conventional way. While Habib and Najib were making their way in the United States, Camille decided to leave Brooklyn for South America. His mother, my father's grandmother Almas, who barely spoke English, had seen an advertisement in the New York Times offering a reward to the person who recovered a sunken dredge full of gold from the Atrato River in the tropical jungles of a remote country called Colombia. The Choco Pacific Gold Mine Company was in dire financial straits due to the accident, and its only hope was to salvage the gold. Speaking not a word of Spanish, Camille arrived in Colombia and gamely made his way into one of the least hospitable rainforests in the world, crossing from the coastal city of Barranquilla through the jungles of the Darién Peninsula. He ended up rescuing the dredge, gaining the reward, and traveling across the Andes to Medellín, where he won the hand of a local beauty. He settled in Colombia and became a successful manufacturer's agent for textile companies, an owner of several textile mills, and co-owner of a boiler factory. He and his family became prominent in Medellín. Indeed, they have felt the negative repercussions of that prominence quite dramatically. Several family members have been kidnapped for ransom, and two were killed by warring Colombian terrorist factions. My father, born in Dallas in 1915, was an only child. My grandmother doted on him, and he wanted for nothing. He attended private school and lived in a beautifully appointed house that doubled as a customer showcase for Halabi Galleries. My grandfather, to his credit, never Americanized his family name, as so many immigrants did. He was accepted nonetheless, and was even invited to join the Dallas Athletic Club, despite the many restrictions they placed against the ethnic groups that were flocking to the New World. His only concession to his adopted country, besides taking the nickname Ned, was to allow his wife to convert him from the Greek Orthodoxy of his childhood to the Christian Science faith. From that time onward, my grandfather followed the teachings of Mary Baker Eddy, who emphasized healing through spiritual means. He and my grandmother did not consult doctors and eschewed the use of medicine, which may have contributed to his death at an early age. After waiting for faith to cure what was thought to be a case of strep throat, Najib Sr. was quite weak when he finally went into the hospital, where he developed an infection and died. My father, his son, was only 12 years old. After her husband's untimely death, Laura Halabi, my paternal grandmother, sold the Halabi Galleries and moved to California. She remarried not long after, this time to an affluent Frenchman from New Orleans. The marriage lasted 6 or 7 years, apparently strained by relations between my father and his stepfather. At least some of the disaffection stemmed from the attention Laura heaped on her son, which made her new husband quite jealous. Indeed, Laura's boy, Jeeb, did much to make her proud. My father excelled at whatever he tried, and lived life with great gusto. He attended Stanford University, where he was captain of the golf team, then went on to Yale Law School. Once he graduated, he became a pioneering aviator, flying the P-38 twin-engine fighters, the Hudson bomber, and the Lockheed Lodestar transport during World War II as a test pilot for Lockheed Aviation. As a Navy pilot in the carrier fighter test branch, he would fly more than 50 different types of aircraft, including the first American-built jet. My father had the temperament so necessary to a test pilot. He was bold, confident in his technical skills, focused, and a risk-taker, as well as possessing an aviator's broad perspective and inherent optimism, personality traits he would share with my future husband. One test of my father's character occurred during his stint in the Navy, when it fell to him to coax the first primitive jet, the YP-59, up to 46,900 feet, the highest altitude any plane had ever reached. He was so excited to have broken the altitude record that he forgot to check the fuel gauges. Both engines flamed out at 12,000 feet, leaving the plane with no power, no radio, and no way to electronically lower the flaps or landing gear. He had to hand-crank the gear down, exactly 127 turns, he noted later, succeeding with seconds to spare at 100 feet over the runway. He then somehow glided the plane in for what is known as a dead-stick landing. Najib Halabi met my mother, Doris Carlquist, at a Thanksgiving party in Washington, D.C., in 1945, a few months after the war ended. My mother was tall and blonde, of Swedish descent, and came, as my father did, from the West Coast. They seemed perfectly suited. Both had come east to join the war effort, he as a test pilot, she as an administrative assistant, first in the Office of Price Administration, then in the State Department's German-Austrian Occupied Affairs branch. They quickly discovered they shared an interest in politics. For the first time, I had found a quick and witty girl who enjoyed this give-and-take debating as much as I did, Najib observed later. And they were both idealistic. Like me, she had stars in her eyes about peace and international understanding, he said. They were married 3 months later. Married life must have been difficult for my mother. My father was an unapologetic workaholic and was rarely at home. After the war, he had joined the Office of Research and Intelligence, a new branch of the State Department. He spent the second summer of their marriage in Saudi Arabia, as civil aviation advisor to King Saud bin Abdulaziz. When Najib returned to Washington, he successfully urged the State Department to increase American military aid and technical assistance to the oil-rich nation. Other governmental departments were being revamped after the war, including the military. When the Defense Department came into being in 1947, unifying the various competitive military branches, my father left the State Department for the Pentagon to work for the first Secretary of Defense, James Forrestal. After Forrestal's tenure came to an end, my father continued at Defense, helping to organize NATO under Truman, and becoming Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Affairs under President Eisenhower. By the time I was born in August 1951, however, he was weary of government service. Money was becoming an issue, and he began to eye the private sector. He met Lawrence Rockefeller at a Naval Reserve Officers' Dinner in 1953. The largest shareholder in Eastern Airlines, Rockefeller offered my father a job. And that year, we moved to New York. My childhood memories begin around this time. My brother Christian was born in 1953. And my sister Alexa in 1955. My nursery school was a few blocks from our apartment on East 73rd Street in Manhattan. In that dark, crowded, overheated schoolroom, I was agonizingly torn between competing instincts to join in or maintain a solitary independence from the group. I can never remember not being shy. As a child, I would make myself scarce when my parents' guests would come to our house, and I knew I would be expected to exchange pleasantries with them. I had a small number of friends, but we were close, which was what mattered to me. We moved often during my childhood, and the constant change reinforced my natural reserve. Every few years I would have to adjust to a new, strange home, and new friends, as well as new schools, neighborhoods, and cities. Time and again I would find myself on the outside looking in, watching, studying, learning, having to familiarize myself with unfamiliar people and communities. My father viewed me as aloof, and my mother, concerned about what she considered my loner temperament, turned to a child psychologist for advice. The psychologist told my mother I would grow out of it, but in truth, I never did. To this day, I am most comfortable when a conversation has an intellectual focus. Perhaps this helps explain why I have always felt particularly inept at and impatient with small talk, intrigues, and gossip. Part of this social awkwardness no doubt stems from a sense of inadequacy, rooted in considerable part in my relationship with my father. He sought perfection and never seemed satisfied. I felt I could never measure up, and as I was the eldest, his expectations for me were the most pronounced. I will never forget one incident in grade school concerning my eyesight, which was extremely poor, though no vision problem had yet been diagnosed. When I could not see the writing on my classroom chalkboard, even from the first row, my mother took me to an optician. Back home, after the visit, my mother explained to my father how truly weak my sight was. He did not believe it at first, or did not want to believe it. He held up a copy of Time magazine and asked me to read it. He held it quite close, but I could not read even the headlines. He still refused to believe I needed eyeglasses. How could one of his children be so flawed? My father learned a great deal about the aviation business working for the Rockefeller brothers, immersing himself in the corporate financing of airlines and the municipal funding of airports, setting up a task force to reorganize and modernize the country's rapidly growing airways and airport systems. When political infighting kept him from being appointed head of the Civil Aeronautics Association, he decided to leave the Rockefellers. Shortly thereafter, he became executive vice president of an electronic subsystems manufacturer, Servo Mechanisms Incorporated, with offices in Long Island and Los Angeles. I was 5 when we moved back to California, supposedly for the summer. My mother says the move was particularly traumatic for me, but I suspect those may have been her own feelings about leaving the East Coast, as I have only happy memories of those years. I loved being outdoors, and I learned to swim in the pool of that first house we rented in Brentwood. The house, which had belonged to the actress Angela Lansbury, had a wonderful garden full of orange and lemon trees. To this day I remember its rich citrus smells. The exuberant bougainvillea vines and the stately palm trees. We moved to another house in the fall, and then a few months later to an enchanting old Victorian situated on the edge of a Santa Monica bluff overlooking the Pacific. With an expansive, tumble-down garden bordered at the end by a row of dilapidated pigeon cages, it was a wonderful house to grow up in, eccentric and full of character, like an old Maine summer hotel. It had, with its high ceilings, an atrium filled with plants, a billiard room, a porch with a huge swing, and a spacious romantic attic in which my father, in a burst of domestic energy, assembled a puppet theater swathed in tiny lights, where we spent many happy hours entertaining family and friends. I contentedly played alone in a vacant lot next to the house, digging in the soil and collecting rocks. I loved to read books under my favorite magnolia tree. It was here, in a little alley near the house, that my father taught me to ride a bicycle. I had to learn quickly, as he had little patience. Perhaps the house's most winning attribute was its proximity to the Pacific Ocean, which I could hear so clearly as it thundered outside my bedroom window, lulling me to sleep, a constant, comforting companion. My preferred refuge was the ocean. I spent hours riding the waves off Santa Monica, often with a favorite raft. The ocean was both freedom and challenge for me, and I was blissfully happy just being out there on my own. Whenever we moved, my paternal grandmother, Laura, would move with us in order to be close to her son and his family. Opinionated and flamboyant, she was an integral part of my early memories of Santa Monica. Often, after classes at the Westlake School, I would walk the short distance to her home and immerse myself in her world, at once artistic and unconventional. With her Art Deco jewelry, loose flowing dresses, and intriguing art and memorabilia, she was the most original person I had ever met. She was also a dedicated Christian Scientist, and I was influenced by her to believe in the power of positive thinking, that an optimistic outlook in life can create positive outcomes, not just for oneself, but for others, too. I was still very young, 9 or 10 at the time, but the two of us would engage in long philosophical discussions about how to live a meaningful and worthy life. As the oldest child, I had to find my own way. Nearer in age to each other, my brother and sister shared a room and seemed very close and companionable. I was sleepless for what seemed like hours and hours every night, intensely conscious of my isolation, the only creature still stirring in a peacefully slumbering house. Restlessness drew me to my father's library, where I would spend hours poring through his eclectic collection of books. I particularly remember Khalil Gibran and Neville Shute, the classics, and the infinitely fascinating Encyclopedia Britannica. I would flip through copies of National Geographic and gaze longingly at the globe that helped me chart my parents' international trips. One day in Santa Monica, I decided to run away from home, certain that at age 9 I was now perfectly capable of looking after myself in the larger world. I dragged a sheet off my bed and piled all my most precious possessions into it, at the last minute adding my entire collection of Nancy Drew books and an alarm clock to the mix. After hauling this unwieldy cargo down the long winding staircase, across the entrance hall, and out the front door, I paused on the front porch to consider my options. It was a balmy summer evening, with the ocean undulating in the distance while the bright ball of the sun gradually dropped beyond the horizon. I so loved that view that I was lulled into a reverie. Suddenly, it was dark. I never made it any farther. My sister loves to tease me about my failed odyssey, saying that several years later, when she attempted the same escape, she at least made it beyond the front porch and across the street. We left California when I was 10, to return to Washington, D.C. John F. Kennedy had been elected president in 1960, and my father had been approached soon afterward by two of his former colleagues at Yale Law School, Sergeant Shriver, Kennedy's brother-in-law, and Adam Yarmolinsky, a Kennedy talent scout, to take over the Federal Aviation Administration. My father was flattered, but reluctant to accept the government post. He had left Servo Mechanisms to start his own technology company in Los Angeles, and was also practicing law. He was finally making good money, and was not in a rush to return to the relative penury of public service. It took a private meeting in Washington with the president-elect, the day before he was inaugurated on January 20, 1961, to convince my father to accept the stewardship of the FAA and to become Kennedy's presidential aviation advisor. My brother, sister, and I were not at President Kennedy's inauguration on that freezing, snowy day in Washington. We watched it on television in sunny California, and saw our parents seated close behind the wind-blown podium where Kennedy took the oath of office. Nor were we in Washington for my father's Senate confirmation hearings, or for his swearing-in ceremony in the Oval Office on March 3, as only the second administrator of the FAA. He could not afford to bring us to Washington. Overnight his income had dropped by 2/3, and the federal government did not contribute to the cost of relocation. So, to my great relief, we remained at home in California for the rest of the school year and the summer. My first inkling of my father's prominence in the Kennedy administration came at a farewell party for him at the Ambassador Hotel in Los Angeles. A helicopter was sent to take us to the lawn at the Ambassador, then on to see my father preside over the ceremonial opening of the new Los Angeles International Airport. I loved my first helicopter ride, which was fortuitous, given the integral role helicopters would play in my future. I was less enthusiastic about the ceremonial role I had to play at the airport. It had been decided that I would have the honor of teaming up with Vice President Lyndon Johnson on stage at the airport to unveil the commemorative plaque. I was almost paralyzed by stage fright, but I did it, and was complimented afterward by a sweetly supportive Ladybird Johnson. Once in Washington, I had further adjustments to make. I had coasted through school in California, but now I was finding the educational system much more rigorous. I was also tall for my age, scrawny and awkward, and dependent on Coke-bottle-thick glasses. I missed California, the sunshine, the ocean, the pungent smell of fresh citrus, the majestic, quirky character of the palms, and the freedom of being outdoors all year round. Fortunately, my grandmother's home, a farm in nearby Centerville, Virginia, provided a peaceful retreat. I already loved horses and spent hours exploring the countryside on a small pony with my grandmother's German Shepherd tagging along behind. It was not far from my grandmother's property that I had my first startling exposure to poverty when I came upon a cluster of dilapidated shacks on the edge of a farming community. I felt absolute shock, fear, and then utter helplessness and guilt as I was confronted by the blank, hopeless stares of migrant children and their families seeking shade from the pitiless noonday sun. As we children reached adolescence, my parents insisted on sending us to private schools. This decision created a further financial burden, but my parents were adamant, and I was sent to the National Cathedral School for Girls. A number of my classmates at NCS were also daughters of transplanted members of the Kennedy administration, and we naturally gravitated to each other, newcomers all. Grace Vance, whose father, Cyrus, the new Secretary of the Army, had attended Yale Law School with my father, became a close friend, as did Carinthia West, whose father, the distinguished General Sir Michael West, was the British representative to NATO in Washington, and Mo Orrick, whose father was an assistant attorney general. Like young girls everywhere, we were captivated by the Beatles, the Beach Boys, and other rock and roll groups, but some of us, because of our parents, were even more interested in national politics and the world scene. The Peace Corps topped the list of career goals in my diary of those Washington years, and there were times, in spite of my friendships at NCS, when I longed to leave the privileged environment of my private girls' school for a less rarefied milieu. I urged my parents to allow me to attend Western High, a public school in Washington, where I knew I would not be so insulated from the social and economic realities of the world, but to no avail. I became aware of racism for the first time. Federal laws prohibited racial discrimination in public schools and universities, but several southern states were either ignoring or defying those laws. The new Kennedy administration's commitment to social justice encouraged civil rights leaders, among them Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr., to press for the enforcement of existing legislation and for sweeping new laws to eradicate racial discrimination once and for all. The powerful television images of African Americans, or Negroes as they were called then, were having a profound impact on me and on many of my classmates. We saw policemen beating protesters for peacefully trying to assert their legal right to vote, to attend school, or even to sit in the front section of a public bus. I will never forget watching the television news with my grandmother in the fall of 1962, when James Meredith, a young black man, tried to enroll at the University of Mississippi. He had to be escorted through a jeering crowd and up the steps by federal agents and even so was turned away time and again by police and state officials. Martin Luther King came on the screen, commenting on the mistreatment of Meredith. Filled with admiration, I said, "Isn't he wonderful?" My grandmother agreed, but it quickly became apparent that she was praising George Wallace, the racist governor of Alabama, who had spoken about the event a few minutes earlier. And the realization triggered an excruciating argument. I stormed off to my room and buried myself in a book until I left the next day. I thought that I would never be able to forgive her, and in some ways, our relationship was never quite the same. A small group of my friends and I supported the civil rights movement through the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC, which had been founded in 1960 to coordinate student sit-ins at segregated lunch counters throughout the South to force their integration. The sit-ins had started informally when four black students in Greensboro, North Carolina, had gone to an F.W. Woolworth store to buy school supplies. When they sat down at the store's segregated lunch counter to eat, they were refused service. More black students returned to Woolworth's the next day, accompanied by a reporter, and soon sit-ins were launched at segregated lunch counters all over the South. By the time I joined SNCC in 1961, the student movement had grown to more than 70,000 participants and had broadened its segregated targets to include public parks, public restrooms, movie theaters, libraries, any place where people assembled. We wore our SNCC pins with pride, marched, and joined protests, adding our youthful voices to the larger call to action. We sang, "We Shall Overcome," and we meant it. Images of police dogs attacking children and powerful water cannons knocking them off their feet were viewed constantly on television sets across the country. And before long, President Kennedy announced that he was sending sweeping civil rights legislation to Congress. We were so young, yet we felt responsible for contributing our voices and energies to the call for social justice. I vividly remember the massive civil rights march in Washington and the rally at the Lincoln Memorial in August 1963, 5 days after my 12th birthday. I could not understand why everyone in the city was not marching that day, or why they were not as inspired by Martin Luther King's "I Have a Dream" speech as I was. Life in Washington was not just about politics. Horseback riding was my other passion, and instinctively, perhaps, I formed a special bond with a magnificent Arabian stallion, Blackjack. I felt particularly capable and at peace with the world when I was on horseback, and I competed whenever possible in regional equestrian events. When my instructor suggested I was ready to compete nationally, I was filled with pride and determined to commit completely to the sport. I also loved singing. My chorus teacher encouraged me to take private lessons, giving me the impression that I had a special talent. But in retrospect, I realized that her suggestion was probably rooted in a desire to save her ears and the reputation of our school choir. For financial reasons, my parents said no to voice and violin lessons, which my mother wisely anticipated would torture the entire household. I discovered the pleasures of flying as well. A few times during those years, my father took me with him on working visits to small-town airports around the country in a small plane. He let me take over the plane's basic navigational controls and work the radio, acting as his co-pilot. During those rare moments, my father and I were in perfect harmony. My father was rarely home during the 4 years he ran the FAA, and when he was home, he was often distracted. One of my most significant memories was of a conversation we had one sunny Sunday morning in the small garden of our Washington home, when my father seemed particularly distressed. I asked what was troubling him, and he explained that he was struggling under a terrible burden of debt, and yet was happier and more fulfilled in public service than in any more lucrative career. I remember being both frightened by his uncharacteristic vulnerability and extremely proud of him. The conversation, perhaps our first adult exchange, had a profound impact on my thinking, my dreams for the future, and my appreciation for sacrifices made for a larger purpose. We were all raised to be independent, perhaps to a fault. My father now says, looking back, that he and my mother probably encouraged us to be too individualistic, islands unto ourselves rather than part of a whole. Perhaps we reflected the growing and irreparable gulf that was dividing our parents. The constant tension between them permeated the household. My father says now that he and my mother differed in terms of faith and intellectual beliefs and philosophy. And he has questioned whether they should have had children at all. But they did, and from an early age we all had to deal with the palpable conflict between them. I protected myself as much as possible from the turbulence in their marriage, trying very hard to distance myself from them emotionally. My father also attributed the seeds of marital disharmony to the very different life experiences my parents had as children, which led to their different expectations as adults. My father considered himself far better educated than my mother, whose father had been in the brokerage business in Spokane, Washington in 1929, when the stock market crashed, and he had never recovered. Her mother, May Ethel Ackroyd Carlquist, had died when Doris was 15. A few years later, she was forced to drop out of college for financial reasons, and instead of living with her father, my mother was passed from relative to relative. Her father had encouraged Doris and her two siblings to be self-sufficient, and my mother had strong professional goals. Yet when she married my father, she gave up her job, as was customary then for married women. Once her children were out of grade school, she dedicated herself to community service, working for a New York settlement house in East Harlem. She also volunteered with public television as well as with a number of organizations promoting U.S.-Arab relations, social welfare in the Middle East, and support for Palestinian refugees, commitments she honors to this day. For all the tension in my parents' marriage, my mother was very fond of the Arab side of the family. Though she had never met Najib Sr., she did meet his brother, Camille, who sent her white orchids from his farm in Colombia when she married my father. I would carry orchids from Camille's farm at my wedding as well. My mother wanted to name me Camille in his honor, but my great-uncle protested. Like many immigrants to the Americas, he felt pressure to assimilate as thoroughly as possible and to de-emphasize his Arab roots. He wanted my parents to name me Mary Jane. They compromised by giving me a name that I never identified with, Lisa. Once I heard that story, I always thought of myself as Camille. As much as I loved and admired my father, we had an extremely difficult relationship. I realized at a fairly early age that the frustrations my father took out on his family stemmed from the impossible standards he set for himself. He had clear goals at the FAA, but he was plagued by partisan infighting as he tried to achieve them. He was also beset with financial problems, a troubled marriage, and the added pressure of being an oddity in WASP, Washington. I remember a quiz in one of the local papers asking, "What is a Najib Elias Halabi, animal, vegetable, or mineral?" My father's dissatisfaction was a reflection of his unrelenting drive to prove himself. During one particularly intense episode at home, I looked up at his face, glowing with rage, and I realized with absolute clarity, "This does not have to do with me, this has to do with him. He is so frustrated that he needs to get it out of his system," I thought to myself. My sister developed a strategy of accommodation, whereas I had a completely different approach. Take me or leave me as I am. Although I may have seemed defiant, I wanted desperately to be accepted for who I was, on my own merit. In an interview many years later, I would describe my family as a typical late 20th century, moderately dysfunctional American family. And I believed that to be an honest and diplomatic description. However, my mother was very upset when she read those words. Maintaining the myth of the ideal family was very important to her generation, which is precisely what kept my parents together for far longer than made any sense. I remember as a teenager begging them to divorce for their own sakes, not what most children want their parents to do, but they remained miserably imprisoned by convention until they finally dissolved their marriage in 1974. Ironically, their divorce eventually freed them to rediscover what they had initially so appreciated in each other, and they have become great friends and confidants over the years. On November 22, 1963, while crossing Woodley Road with my classmates on our way to the athletic field, I heard a devastating report from Dallas, Texas, on the crossing guard's radio. President Kennedy's motorcade had come under fire, and there were concerns that the occupants of his car might have been hit. The news moved like wildfire through the school. When the National Cathedral's bells began to toll their tragic message later in the day, we were devastated. It was inconceivable that our dashing young president